This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The filmmakers Taryn Southern and Elena Gabby wanted to make a film that explores how neurotechnology, that is, devices and electrodes implanted in people's brains, how that could change what it means to be human. I Am Human is the name of the film. And in some ways, it's like a declaration of some of the people featured who are having these devices and electrodes implanted in their own brains. There's a man who's severely paralyzed, and if his device works, he could use his brain to tell his limbs to move again. Or a blind man whose device could help him see light and shapes and his own sister again. Or a woman who can turn a switch on a little box and quiet the tremors of her Parkinson's disease. I mean, that's amazing, right? But the film is also about the questions that come with this technology. How far can this go, or should it go? What are the risks? Who has access to these devices? Today in the program, we're talking about the film. It's the latest in our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Next Wednesday, we're screening I Am Human, and we'll give you more details about that a little later on the show. Taryn Southern and Elena Gabby are joining us, and we'll start with Taryn, who says she started thinking about all of this because she noticed a difference between all the scary stuff you hear about technology in the future and what was really out there.
I've always been passionate about telling stories about the future. And in fact, when I started working on this project, I was actually doing some creative work with artificial intelligence, and that was leading me down the path of learning a lot more about what was happening in the neurotechnology space, and it was absolutely fascinating. Meanwhile, Black Mirror and Westworld, which I'm sure many of your audience have seen, or if not seen, heard about, became these massive global hits. And it became clear that the public was really fascinated in what was happening in the space, but what was being portrayed in the media was quite a bit different than, from what was actually happening in the world of neuroscience. And so it seemed like there was this massive opportunity or this gap for us to fulfill, to come in and actually tell these stories of the first humans to receive these implantable devices in their brains, and in essence, tell the story of the world's first cyborgs, not the Westworld kind.
Yeah, the real ones. Elena, how were you thinking about it in the beginning?
Yeah, well, my background is really straightforward documentary filmmaking, and my passion with that is to find ways to democratize information about really complicated topics that aren't necessarily accessible to everyday people. And I think neuroscience and technology are two of those topics that affect us so much and yet are so inaccessible to the everyday person. So I think I was fascinated by the challenge of that as a non-scientist, as a non-tech person, but as a filmmaker. How well could I get that information across? And then when I started to learn about what these people were going through that were considering these brain implants, on a human level, it fascinated me. The questions about what does it mean to be the first, you know, of something. So I think it really just the challenge of how to talk about the science in a way that's entertaining and fun and deep and thought-provoking was what drew me to the project.
You know, it's Taryn, I've seen you described as a techno-optimist. And so I'm wondering what the interplay was between you and Elena, not that you're a techno-pessimist, Elena, but what was the interplay? Because there's two things going on in the film. On one hand, there's the stunning possibilities of this technology on the brain. But the other part is like, wait a minute, what is this going to mean? Are we going too fast? All those kinds of things. So I'm wondering how you were both talking to each other and then conveying those two parts.
Well, you hit the nail on the head that there are two simultaneous conversations happening, both in the film and in reality. And I think you can't have one without the other. Even as a techno-optimist, I think of being a techno-optimist as trying to lay the groundwork for a positive future. And part of that is creating an aspiration or creating a vision for where this technology could go that is positive, that does help inspire young people to pursue these fields and for the right reasons, while also being responsible in asking the big questions. And I think it's probably accurate that when Elena and I began working together on this, I was more in the enthusiastic camp. I don't know if is that fair to say, Elena? I was more in the techno-enthusiastic camp, and Elena was a lot more hesitant about what was happening in the space. And I think what we came to realize was that the longer that you're in the space or in learning about the research that's going on, simply the more comfortable you become with the ideas. Because I think by the end of the 2.5 years of working together, Elena had also become so much more comfortable with a lot of these ideas. And so it was interesting to watch each other evolve in our thinking. But I'll let Elena speak to her own experience with regards to that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I was skeptical, but also really confused and didn't understand. And I think for me, the journey was about realizing that confusion oftentimes leads to fear and skepticism and worry, whereas knowledge and, you know, a much deeper level of understanding allows there to be nuance and allows there to be beauty in the possibility when you really understand sort of that a lot of the fears maybe are a bit gut reaction and not really based on the information that's being presented or the phase that we're at now. So I was able to learn that over time. And also just being with these subjects that we followed, one of them is a blind man, one of them has tetraplegia, and one of them is an artist with Parkinson's. And to kind of be with them and experience it from their eyes really changed the perspective. I was no longer looking at it from a fear approach all the time. I was looking at it from that perspective of what can this do to really impact people's lives today, right now.
You know, if you set aside those two parts, though, you know, the possibility of technology and the ethical questions that come with it, it seems like if you boil it down, it's about what it means to be human. And I guess that's what the title implies. Like, that's the basic question, maybe.
Part of the title also refers to this idea that what it means to be human is somehow involves our brains, because our brains are what makes us who we are and what makes us unique as a species. It's one of the things. And for us, I think we kind of decided that it was the thing for the purpose of our film and our exploration. So then the question is, if you can change what the brain can do or how it can do it, are you changing what it means to be human? And that's really the question here that we're looking at.
So one of the questions that you get at the beginning is, like, what is the stuff we know about the brain, and what is the part that we don't know? And for the most part, we don't know most of what's going on in the brain in some ways, like, right? I mean, explain the thing that scientists have to crack or understand, because one of the neuroscientists in the film describes it as the code of movement. That was really interesting.
Well, it's so funny. When you talk to neuroscientists, you'll hear a lot of different things about what they know regarding the brain. And most neuroscientists, as any good scientist, they are very conservative in their proclamations about what they know. And they'll often say, we don't know anything about the brain, but then you tell the average person what they can do with their lack of knowledge, and it's and it's quite extraordinary. So, you know, the brain is the most complicated engine in the body. It's very, very difficult to get inside the skull and actually figure out what's going on without, for lack of a better term, killing the person that you're trying to study. There's 88 billion neurons, and they're all chattering with each other, and we have very rudimentary tools to understand what it is that they're saying. But even with the massive holes that we have in knowledge about the brain. With what we do know, we can already accomplish some pretty extraordinary things, and we can also infer a lot about how it is that we construct identity, how it is that we construct our senses, our, you know, our physical senses like vision and movement, through what little we do know. Hmm. And so I think that alone is something that's quite interesting and important for people to understand, that as we continue down this path of technological evolution, where our technology is getting faster, smarter, and smaller, what is going to happen as we make these tiny steps forward? What kinds of giant leaps might we actually create? And what might happen sooner than any of us really would ever expect?
I like this idea that there's this internal language in the in the brain that, and we don't really know. Well, as is expressed in this clip, there's, here's a moment from the film. We'll hear from the science fiction writer Ramiz Nam and various other neuroscientists that, you know, we, there's a code there, and we don't, we haven't cracked it yet. Here's a moment from the film.
The brain has always been a black box to us. In the past, we've had rudimentary ideas of how it works.
We know that there are circuits that control your vision, your memory, your movement.
But we still don't know the code. We don't know the internal language. That's because the brain is the most complicated object we've ever encountered in nature.
You know, think about it. We have in each human brain roughly 100 billion neurons. 100 billion was the old estimate of the number of galaxies in the universe.
Each neuron is as complicated as the city of Los Angeles. It's connecting to about 10,000 of its neighbors. So you have, you know, 500 trillion connections.
And these neurons, they communicate with each other. And they're firing electrical signals to each other. The same way our computers fire zeros and ones inside of themselves.
To think about those individual neurons firing at a speed that we can't even understand yet, it's mind-boggling.
It's so unbelievably complicated, and yet, somehow it is us.
That's the neuroscientist David Eagleman there at the end. What does he mean when he says that? This is who we are. This is us.
I think in part that depends on your philosophical views on personal identity.
Right.
But any neuroscientist would likely argue that our identity is simply a very finely tuned algorithmic pattern of electrical impulses that that are happening between neurons that are the result of our senses and our personal experiences and perhaps our genetic code. But if we were to pit that against perhaps another scientist or philosopher, they might have a very different view of that. We can argue that if someone suffers from a mental disorder or severe brain damage, I mean, you actually see that they become a different person. So for most of us, we would not refute the fact that the brain is incredibly critical to this idea of who we are.
Taryn Southern and Elena Gabby, they co-directed the film I Am Human, which we're showing next Wednesday. That's January 8th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
A recent NPR survey revealed that 21% of American adults now own at least one smart speaker. Maybe you have one, but you don't know what to do with it.
Smart speaker, what's the diameter of the world's largest pizza? When is Tan France's birthday? Set a reminder about my birthday and send it to the media.
Sure, you can ask it random questions, but your smart speaker is also an excellent way to listen to your favorite public radio station. Just tell your device, play KUER, or visit KUER.org for details.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're talking about the documentary I Am Human. It explores the possibilities of neurotechnology, and it's raising questions about what it means to be human. We have with us the directors of the film, Taryn Southern and Elena Gabby. We'll be screening it next Wednesday night. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Let's talk about some of the characters in the film. Let's start with Brian Johnson. Explain who he is and what he's doing. He is, he's consumed by this, the possibilities of this technology.
Yeah, Brian is an entrepreneur, successful entrepreneur. His previous company that he founded, Braintree, many of us use on a daily basis, but may not actually know the name. It is the technology that powers a lot of apps like Uber and Yelp in terms of the back-end payment process.
Yeah.
And after he sold that, he decided that he wanted to embark on a new journey to work on something epic. And since he had the resources to do so, he started a neuroscience company with exactly that aim in mind, to better understand the human brain and how technology might be able to interface with it to improve where it is that we're going. And for us, Brian served an important piece of the film in providing context for what was actually happening in the space, giving us an inside look at the thinking and the behind the scenes working of a consumer or corporate commercial entity.
Yeah.
And helping us really unwrap all of the different components of this industry.
He's interesting because he's motivated by his own, I guess, his own problems he's had with his brain. Severe depression is one of the things. And so he's really intent on understanding the brain and fixing the parts that don't work. And I think what's interesting, too, about him is he's not reckless, but he has the sense of urgency that absolutely comes through. He wants to plow forward with all of this.
Right. And I think what you said that's really important from what I observed after spending so much time was that he's not reckless, right? Because he's almost someone that I would hold up as an example of how to approach this in a better way. He's spending a lot of time developing the technology, but he's also spending a lot of time and effort and resources to try to get people to understand the technology along each step of the way together with him. Mm-hmm. So he's helping teach people what it's doing, what it is, how to have the conversation about ethics, and trying as best as he can to bring them along with the journey if they're interested in coming. So that's something that I think is really, really important, and I would love to encourage, you know, all the people working in this field to make sure that they're also giving some energy to those conversations that are really, really important.
Give us a sense of what's out there. One of the places we go in the film is to the Wyss Center in Switzerland, the Wyss Center for Bio and Neuroengineering. They're doing amazing things there. They're developing this implantable technology, and then they test it. Talk a little bit about the brain electrode, because this is it's amazing.
It is amazing, and Wyss has been doing it for quite some time, and
yeah,
there are other companies in the space that we were also partnered with or involved with on some level, like BlackRock Microchip Systems, which is based in Utah, and their technology is used in a few of the subjects, and they also work with Wyss. But a lot of there are a number of companies out there developing this technology, Paradromics, a company called Synchron. Obviously, a lot of listeners might have heard of Neuralink. And they're all just simply approaching this problem from a slightly different angle. And that is, how do you make implantable technology that is, well, that can last long in the that's durable, that can hold up under the very challenging conditions of a wet and hot brain? How do you get it into the brain with as little scarring as possible and with the least invasive methods? And how do you do so in a way that's affordable, at least affordable enough for the average person who requires this technology to actually receive it? And so many of them are developing what they call electrodes, which are, for lack of a better term, a chip that goes inside the brain and records neurons from these tiny little sheaths. And the number of electrodes that are recorded is oftentimes equated with the value of the technology. Like I said earlier, we have approximately 88 billion neurons. Most of the electrode technologies today record maybe 100 neurons from 100 electrodes. And so the more electrodes that you have on the technology, it's presumed to be better, although that may not necessarily always be the case. And so a lot of the companies that we've been talking to, it's all about how do they create smaller technology that's less invasive but can record even more neurons, or in other words, have greater electrode capacity.
Yeah. Here's another moment from the film. This is what happens when the brain electrode is implanted. It translates these impulses into a code that we can understand. We're going to hear from this John Donahue of the Weiss Center, as well as Ramiz Nam, the writer.
Once inside, these electrodes can pick up the tiny electrical impulses of the neurons and convert them into a signal we can understand, like a digital code.
It's a messy, messy, messy code. There's 100 billion neurons. But once you're getting data out of the brain, you have digital information. You can do with it anything you can do with digital information.
It's called the brain-computer interface.
Brain-computer interfaces give us the ability to understand the brain, to understand its electrical signals, in order to replace lost function.
So this was an important, I think, part for me. Once you translate it, it's completely incomprehensible to most people when you think about it. They're in the brain as this thing. But then if you can translate it into a code, like if you can look at it, you know,
if you can hear it.
Or if you can hear. Yeah, that was cool too.
So the little pops that you hear in that clip, not the music, but the sound pops that kind of go. Those are neurons firing. And that's a real recording of real neurons that you can pick up once you have these electrodes in the brain. So when you hear the, I think it really helps you see how the zeros and ones firing metaphor and the on-off really makes sense, because that putt-putt-putt is – you can imagine how that putt-putt-putt could be translated to something like a zero or a one. It's either on or it's off.
Yeah.
These scientists, in much like we would think about Morse code, they're taking these audio recordings, the signaling, and they're running hundreds, thousands of tests and creating algorithms in hopes of deconstructing what those patterns actually represent. And then they can pair those patterns with things like movement and vision and audio to better understand how our brain functions.
There's the part that is really invasive and really expensive and complicated, and well, it's always complicated. But then there's the part that Brian Johnson is interested in, and that is, what if it wasn't so expensive? What if it wasn't so invasive? And what if it wasn't just for people who are in these extreme situations, who have, you know, Parkinson's or if they're paralyzed or something like that. And I wanted to ask about this part of it because there's this moment in the film where we should talk about the technology that he's developing first, because the idea of seeing that of neurons or this your brain movement right in front of you is really, really fascinating. Talk about what Brian Johnson's after with this technology.
Yeah, so I think Brian looked at those problems of invasiveness and felt that in order for this technology to really get out there to a mass population that goes beyond people who have tried everything else but need this last resort treatment, that there was not really a high probability that people would electively decide to have brain implants, even if they could afford it, to fix something that might not be so life-threatening, but that might be really important. How many people walk around every day struggling with anxiety and depression? It may not limit them to the point where they can't function at all, but it might be limiting enough that if you could relieve them from that, they would be a different person in an extraordinary way. And so this idea that this could be available for people who are at lesser degrees of severity and also maybe people who don't have an ailment at all, because he doesn't necessarily see that as being a bad thing.
Right.
So I think that potential for people to kind of have a tool that would be a Fitbit for the brain, for lack of a better term, that would really just allow you to have the data and information about your day-to-day that is normally invisible to all of us as we go through our lives.
Here's another moment from the film. This is Brian Johnson.
Imagine you had a brain interface. You can just put on your head, no surgeries required, and you could see all of your brain activity. Not just what you're aware of, but all your brain activity. All of your thoughts, concerns, it was just out in front of you. So for example, if you struggle with anxiety, you'd see in your brain activity that you've had this thought 94 times today, and it's probably not necessary. Could this help you so you don't have that thought 94 times? Or can you see in this thought process that you were limiting your ability to do something because you didn't believe you could do it? But that's a limiting belief. You really can do it. And if we have the technology that gives us the ability to improve how our brains function, can we rethink the things that have always held us back?
What does he mean? Like our sense of regret and ambition and like the big stuff, the stuff that it's abstract. You can't really... But if you could see it, if you could see that it was happening, that's amazing to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, that was a game-changing idea. And in the actual interview, he spoke at much greater length about all the other tools that we currently use to be able to quantify what is happening in our bodies, such as calorie counters for our food or sleep trackers now that we can wear on our wrists or our fingers that indicate whether we have deep sleep or REM sleep or light sleep, and then being able to pair that with our behavior so that we can make adjustments and therefore optimize to become our best selves. And when he translated that into thoughts in the brain and how often our monkey minds take over, and 94th anxious thoughts is just one example, but you know there are so many others in terms of being human is really hard, and we have this very primitive reptilian brain that often likes to be the loudest in the room. And that means that sometimes we react in ways that are not in our best interest and often let fear or, we're basically still stuck on the prairie scanning the horizon for predators, even though that may not actually be what's happening in our day-to-day lives. And that's our brains doing that. And so if we had a tool that helped us at least see what was going on, so that we could be more self-aware and make better choices and potentially fine-tune our own brains so that we're not trapped by the things that hold us back. I think that's such a powerful idea, and it's not different from any of the ideas that are present in current self-help culture with meditation and yoga, but it's just a different way of looking at it, and it's hopefully providing us with a real technological tool to verifiably show us what's going on.
Bill Koshevar is in the film. He has a bicycling accident. He's in Cleveland. He's left deeply disabled, a tetraplegic, I think, as you guys had mentioned before. And before we talk about his story, I just have to say that there are shots of Bill, his head, with these threaded posts coming out of it that are kind of startling and really freaky. And I think it's going to make a few people cringe a little bit, which is, I guess, the point of some of this anyway, that you're fusing a machine with a biological thing, and that is disconcerting to see.
Absolutely. I think there's a reason why we were visually excited to show those posts, because as a filmmaker, you're always looking for the visual metaphors to tell the story. And if we're telling a story about man and machine merging, there's no better visual than these pieces of hardware sticking out of Bill's head. That is it. I think that's what we wanted to communicate visually when we filmed that. And then to show how matter of fact he is about it. I mean, to him, it's like, oh, yeah, this is my day to day. This is my, okay, now they're just going to screw in the, giant bolts that connect me to that computer over
right,
there.
Right.
I mean, this biology meets technology revolution. It is happening right in front of us, and most people just aren't aware of it.
Yeah.
And I would say 95% of the people who have deep brain implants don't have the screws sticking out of their head like Bill. Bill was part of a big experiment that necessitated that. But there are others like Bill around the globe, and I think there's really no, as Elena said, there's really no other way to demonstrate this evolution of mankind into whatever we would call next than that kind of visual. Silicone meets biology.
Yeah, for sure. So in the film, there are these scenes, various of these actually, I have to say, where these procedures are being done. And I have to say they're really dramatic. They're exciting. They're kind of scary. So here's a moment with Bill and the people at Case Western to give listeners a sense of the film. Here's another moment from I Am Human.
We have two microelectrode arrays implanted into Bill's primary motor cortex, 4x4 millimeters in size, and 96 recording electrodes. Each electrode penetrates the cortical tissue 1.5 millimeters in depth and can record the activity of individual neurons.
So, Bill, one of the things we need to do is we need to calibrate the decoder. So watch, and then also imagine you're performing those same movements.
We have them watch an animation of an arm, imagine themselves as controlling those movements, and we'll build this algorithm decoding the movement intention.
Excellent.
We then send that intention to electrodes implanted in Bill's arm and hand. And our goal is to restore movement.
Okay, Bill, I'm going to go ahead and connect you. Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay, it's on.
If the electrical activity in Bill's brain can stimulate in the right pattern, you can get an arm to move, a hand to open, a hand to close.
So that's the idea. They're trying to get him to use his brain that's been damaged. All these neurons have been, the pathways are not there to sort of restore that and to get him to be able to move again.
That's exactly right. And what was super interesting, or unique rather, about that experiment about this experiment is it's the first one wherein they're attempting to get him to move his own arm, not a robotic arm.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's they've got electrodes implanted in his arm, so this computer that's interfacing between the brain and the arm is basically translating those broken signals, and that's really cool.
It's really cool, and we won't give too much away about how it plays out. I mean, but there are, you know, there's still technical challenges. There are, as you said, the signals in the brain are still changing. They're still having to fine-tune all of this. So you get a sense of how, for Bill and some of the other, you know, stories, people whose stories you tell are, it can be frustrating. It can be exciting. It can be poignant. It's amazing that way too. Let's talk about Anne Shabison. Lives in Canada, Bolton, Canada. She has Parkinson's. Let's talk about her story, because this is really interesting. There's a procedure that's available to Parkinson's patients. I have to say I had no idea about any of this. And it's to explain the procedure. It's the idea. It's, again, it's another invasive, complicated procedure, but it's basically about getting a device into the body to stimulate the brain.
Right. So it's called deep brain stimulation. And what they're doing is implanting an electrode that's very skinny and long, like compare it to a piece of spaghetti that's not cooked. And it's going in the brain, and it's going to fire electrical signals because neurons communicate electrically. And it's going to correct the symptoms that Anne is experiencing. So it's not going to solve the Parkinson's disease, but it is going to tell the brain to stop the symptoms. And we don't know exactly how that works, but we know that you can stop things like tremor, akinesia, which is the sort of momentary paralysis that can happen. It makes you not be able to move. In Anne's case, she also had symptoms of anxiety, insomnia. She complained that her smile wasn't the way that it used to be, that she had kind of glossy eyeballs. And these were all the things that the Parkinson's manifested with her. And the deep brain stimulator basically course corrects for the neurons that are misfiring and tells them how to fire in such a way that those symptoms don't happen anymore.
But here's the thing. She's not sure she wants to do it. She raises these – she has these questions about it. So let me play another moment in the film. You'll hear Anne, of course, but also Andre Lozano, a neurosurgeon.
Patients are worried, you know, will I be the same coming out as I was going in?
Someone's cutting into your brain. You don't know what's going to happen.
There's a tremendous amount of anxiety about whether they are going to change in their outlook, in their personality, in their motivation, in their drive. You know, this is brain surgery. It's invasive. It is a scary thought.
They say my symptoms might improve. But cutting your body open and putting things in your body, I don't think I'm capable of risking that.
And this is an important theme in the film because the nature of her anxiety is, you know, a lot of people have that feeling. It's not just about the medical risk, but it seems like it's also the larger question of what happens when you put a device in your body.
That's right. And that doctor, Dr. Andre Lozano, he's done more of these surgeries, I believe, than any other neurosurgeon in the world. And so he has seen a lot happen in patients and, you know, a lot of incredible things happen in these patients, but also a lot of unintended effects of the device. And so these questions are highly relevant. How will it change your personality? You don't know. And it takes some fine-tuning to figure that out. Although what's interesting is we've become very comfortable as a society taking pills for these kinds of things, and there are all kinds of unintended side effects with pharmaceuticals. So it's not that this is totally uncharted territory for us, but somehow I think when it's a metal device and requires surgery, of course, there are more grave concerns about how permanent this could be.
Yeah.
And I think, too, with Anne, if you're trying to fix a motor symptom like tremor, that might not be something that we consider to be so key to personality. But Dr. Lozano has also started trials of deep brain stimulation, as well as others, for things like Alzheimer's. So there was a case where he was implanting a deep brain stimulation electrode into a patient in a memory circuit and was able to stimulate a vivid memory from that person's past.
Wow.
So I think when we start to get into stimulation for things that might be closer to consciousness, personality, that's when we really start to see it. And not to give too much away with what Anne goes through, but one of her symptoms was anxiety, and that is something that's a little bit closer to a personality trait than just a motor symptom.
Right.
And she had debilitating anxiety. I mean, it was I would say that was probably one of her
largest concerns.
Yeah. And so to see how something like this could impact that, which is a bit more subjective and, relies on the patient describing their own emotional experience is very interesting. But these DBS systems, they're very good at rerouting the reward system of the brain, the dopamine system, if you will, and that system is responsible for all kinds of things, like whether or not we want to get out of bed in the morning to do work, or things like addiction, things like obsessing with food. So there are a number of trials with DBS underway for things like obsessive compulsive disorder and eating disorders and obesity. And it's hard. You start getting into a very fuzzy line between are these things ailments? Are they just biochemical reactions in the brain? Are they disorders? Where is the line between disorder and just being a human being?
Yeah. Well, it's that fuzzy line that you deal with. It's an important part of the story, because what happens when or if technology can make you better? How far do you expand it? And it's a question that's asked in the film, well, by a number of people, but Nita Farahany, a professor of law and philosophy at Duke, raises these questions also. Let me play another moment from the film.
How many of you feel like your sense of self is in your brain? Many of you, right? Many of you identified your brain as the place that you recognize your sense of self-identity, the place that you sort of think of you as being located. And if you change that, if you start to add machines to it, if you start to implant electrodes to it, at what point does that start to become problematic? There is great benefit to these technologies, but there are risks. For example, who has access to those devices? Who gets to drive and change those devices? Whether it's hackers, corporations, governments, other people, what protections, if any, exist within society today? It's arriving. And unless we start deciding today what kinds of protections you want for your brain, it may be too late. Does that make you uncomfortable? Because that's where we're going.
Does that make you uncomfortable?
Yes. It will make everyone coming to the screening uncomfortable, and everyone who sees the film uncomfortable. I mean, That's the thing that's interesting about this, too. There's this moment in the film where someone in a class or something is saying something really important, that for people who started social media or started these major technological companies, they had really good intentions. But they didn't foresee the stuff we're seeing now, you know, as this mm-hmm. person mentioned, levels of depression and anxiety and addiction. And so how do we do this right this time? What do you think about that? Because – and I wonder if you worry. There's a sense that maybe we're going too fast without thinking about that part. If you can even slow this down at all, which I doubt.
I certainly think awareness is the first step, and that's part of the reason that we're making this film.
Yeah.
So that – I mean, if people don't even know what's happening, how can we even begin to ask the questions? And the reality is technology is moving at this massive – at this warp speed pace. So it's impossible for the ethical debate to even keep up with the actual development. But you have to try. I mean, we don't have to extend our imaginations that far to see a dystopic version of this. So it's imperative that storytellers and basically anyone working in the sciences are very focused at and create a, you know, make this part of their priority list to get the word out about what's going on and how we can involve everyone in the conversation.
Brian Johnson says it's important for us to be ready for this. And it made me wonder, how do we get ready for this? Do we even know?
I think that, you know, information is power. It's the thing that changes your fear response to a response of, okay, how can I get in this? How can I really understand what they're trying to develop? Because if you understand that the technology is built with these components and it works in this particular way, and then you learn that the fear is that it could get potentially hacked, right? So let's say Bill's brain implant was hacked and someone else could control his own arm movements for him without his permission. That would be one example of how this could go wrong. Okay, so then the question is, how do we design the device better? How do we safeguard it? How do we give him an override in some way? And so it can get that specific, but it can also be as general as something which Nita Farahani also kind of advocates, is that we have freedom of speech in our Constitution, but we don't necessarily have freedom of thought. So what are some of these expanded definitions that need to be at play moving forward? And how can we try to get ahead of that in as best as way that we can? Certainly not by being in the dark. That would be the opposite of how we get ready.
And Elena and I certainly don't have the answers. We made this film to ask these questions and hope that people who are really smart are thinking about them. But, you know, this is a problem that we're seeing across the board in all areas of policy that involves technology, and that is that there's just a lack of knowledge. And we saw that with the Zuckerberg trials, where we have our congressional leaders asking questions about how Facebook works that would make any 22-year-old cringe. There needs to be a baseline understanding of what this technology even is, what it's capable of doing, to even start creating good policy and ethical guidelines around it. And the reality is, it is going to be a nation-by-nation sort of unique, there'll be a nation-by-nation unique approach and perspective on all of this based on the cultural values and ideas present in that specific place. You know, China's going to have a very different propensity toward brain implants than the United States. That's the reality. So then how do we think about that from an economic and political perspective? And that, I don't know. That's what I'm hoping economists and politicians will be prepared for.
That's Taryn Southern, along with Elena Gabby. They co-directed the film I Am Human, which we're going to be screening next Wednesday night. That's January 8th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd like to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Oliver Yarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Beck Fabrizio.